Next on FM 91, it's Know Your Media, the monthly program hosted by Dr. Zach Gershberg, airing on the third Monday of every month at 7:30 p.m. Dr. Gershberg welcomes historian Dr. Justin Stover of Idaho State University in this episode of Know Your Media.
Hello and welcome to KISU's Know Your Media. I'm Zach Gershberg, your host, and welcome to our first episode for 2021. My, has it been an eventful year already in media? Last we spoke in November was after the election when it seemed a little bit in doubt. I had to cancel the December episode as I had contracted the COVID viral infection. But we're here in January, and I'm joined happily by another ISU professor, Justin Stover, a historian who has a PhD in modern European history from Trinity College in Dublin. His focus is on European history, but also on revolution, specifically with Ireland and France and Great Britain. And I felt that Justin would be a pretty terrific person to speak with a week out from the insurrection we had in our nation's capital. Justin, welcome. Happy New Year. Good to see you via Zoom. Thank you for joining us.
Zach, Happy New Year to you as well. I'm really happy that you asked me to do this. There's lots going on in my head, so maybe we can make sense of it in the context of history and the events of this week.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I think it's good to speak to a historian on the day where we not only made history in the sense that we have, for the first time, had a president who's now been impeached twice, but really remarkably, you know, I think, Justin, is to what extent the events of January 6th, I mean, is this going to be a big historical moment like 9/11, the JFK assassination? Can you contextualize any of this for American history or world history or the history of democracy?
Yeah, I can do my best. I mean, to be completely honest, sometimes our national politics become so bizarre and toxic, I have to kind of step away and bury my head in the sand. But this was something that caught my attention, as very few things have before. And I think I was just immediately caught by the fact that this was a physical occupation of the Capitol, which, you know, this changes the entire, I suppose, environment of the Capitol to one of what's supposed to be a peaceful and civilized legislation and discussion to an occupied space of potential violence. So, I mean, certainly American history is built on the idea of protest and the First Amendment and the exercise and the exercising of your rights. Normally, we let our elected officials do this and talk it out on the House floor. Historically, I think there's a number of precedents, the number of contexts we could look at this, but I almost don't want to give credence to the Capitol Hill insurrection, saying that it had the same kind of sophistication as perhaps, like we were talking earlier, the March on Rome or even the Beer Hall Putsch, both different outcomes in those contexts, but of a far more nuanced understanding of their own politics. This, what we saw this week, I think perhaps a failure of security mixed with an incitement by the commander in chief and the failure of local security forces to protect the Capitol.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a really good point. I mean, it's so bizarre because, you know, the media images that we all saw, and I mean, there are some incredible still photography, but some of these people who were, some of the insurrectionists were just taking selfies, but others seemed hell-bent on reaching the House chambers. They broke into the office of the Speaker of the House. Some of them were looking for Mike Pence. And I think the timing, and I'm curious what your take here is, I think the timing is really important. The fact that the rally in which the president spoke was timed to end just as Congress was getting down to business. And that business is important. It was specifically a sort of symbolic counting of the electoral votes. Mm-hmm. But the objections threw that into doubt. And quite obviously, this was, I mean, the very definition of sedition is exercising violence to thwart the execution of law in a society. And so I'm kind of curious, like, this wasn't a rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan. This wasn't a rally on a day when Congress is debating, I don't know, healthcare legislation. This was a day in which the Congress was, affirming the peaceful transition of power. And this was a rally that went from less than a mile over into the Capitol.
Yeah, absolutely. It's shocking in a lot of ways. And I think it's important to note, first of all, human nature is very impressionable. And the power of a mob to change a collective mentality of people can certainly be incited by timing or orchestration. And I'm not even sure I believe in coincidence anymore in politics, as particularly American politics. It seems all orchestrated. So the symbolic timing of this, in which they're in the process of counting votes to affirm that President-elect Biden was indeed going to succeed the office, doesn't seem like a coincidence. And a show of force, if anything, is intimidating, particularly in a place in which that is not the nature of the business to be done in that building. So no, I don't believe it's a coincidence. I think it was intentionally orchestrated this way. And I think the scary part of all of it is that there were many who had willingly traveled to the Capitol to participate in this. Mm-hmm. And other media outlets had been doing podcasts early in the week, Michael Barbaro on the New York Times, talking about the ways in which people were coming in on buses and orchestrating themselves to travel to the Capitol. This isn't new in history either. And if we get a chance to talk about the March on Rome, that's a perfectly good example paralleling with Italy. But this was orchestrated, and social media helped that. Parler, as the French would say, parlor, as the rest of us would say. They're organizing themselves. So this isn't a spontaneous reception of news in which a group, and maybe it would manifest itself into a mob, would react. So I'm sure. Saying it's not reactionary. It's pro action. Yeah.
I mean, it's so interesting, right? Like while this is going on, the president is not, he's like watching it on TV, waiting to see how it all plays out. And his election attorney, Lynn Wood, down in Georgia, is on Parler calling for the execution of the vice president. I feel as though the timing, especially when we talk about part of the articles of impeachment are about these terms like incitement to insurrection. We have a strong First Amendment sort of case law in this country that goes back about 100 years. And so some of those terms, I mean, that will be kind of figured out, I guess. But I guess what I do want, and we're speaking with Dr. Justin Stover, a history professor here at ISU. You're listening to Know Your Media on KISU. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you was parts of your research focus, and know is Irish history, and I'm really curious. You know, there's all these terms being thrown about whether these people were terrorists or insurrectionists or revolutionaries. And I am curious, the line between terrorism and revolution, I know, has played a role a little bit, at least in Irish history. And like, how do we be careful with these terms and use them accurately?
Oh, that's a great question. A lot of times I talk about the ways in which cognitive dissonance often helps societies to understand their own past, often in a very sanitized way. Brushing over some of the unpleasantness that is used to form nations, violence being usually at the forefront. But the notion of a terrorist or a freedom fighter is simply subjective, I think. And, you know, the old cliches about the winners write the history books, or, you know, one person's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, that's certainly relevant. And I think the danger in this is when the self-perception of an act of terror is seen as an act of liberation or an act of patriotism, if that kind of doctrine spreads and actually becomes part of your active psyche, that is where I think it becomes dangerous. Because you will excuse, or individuals will excuse themselves from horrendous acts, so long as it's done in the name of liberty or the nation or patriotism or whatever you have it. I guess the example from the Irish history is, as you mentioned, I think the most apt example would be from the 1960s troubles that lasted for 40 years. But even in the period that I'm most familiar with, the Irish Revolution, terrible acts of violence and ostracism and terror are carried out in Ireland in the name of the Irish Republic, in the name of liberty, against other native-born Irish men and women who happen to be sympathetic to the British cause or in compliance with it, or simply in the past have acted in a way that would have supported the British state. And so when people are breaking into the Capitol, calling for blood or calling for the vice president or the speaker of the House, the issue must be like, when does the notion of terror end? Because certainly I'd have to think any normal human being who'd been threatened with violence would not quickly or easily forget that threat.
Sure.
And so we talk about the installation of trauma as well.
I'm curious, is the nature of revolution understood from a historical perspective as a function of independence? I mean, many Americans, we know about the American Revolution. Just thinking in terms of the Irish Republic, that movement in the early 20th century was about independence. And then the Troubles often, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, was that it was kind of these sort of independence movements. It doesn't strike me as what happened on January 6th, 2021. It wasn't an independence movement. It was...
No.
That's why it's sedition or...
Yeah, exactly. And once again, I mean, should the American Revolution have failed, George Washington would have been hung in London on for everyone to see. But the fact that it succeeded allows us to write our own narrative. In the case of, say, the Northern Ireland Troubles, the issue for the Catholic community was that of civil rights and equal participation in society. And for the Unionists, overtly Protestant population, it was about the maintenance of a dominant way of life and culture in the province of Ulster. Historians of nationalism and revolution, Alan Todd in particular, talk about revolution as a process. Revolution is not something you would probably actively declare as you're doing it, as the news snippet of the woman who was maced when she crossed the threshold. I later saw she had an onion in her hand or something like that. That's more of a Vox story, I think. But no, you're not participating in a revolution because you're not sure where it's going to end. Revolutions, it was famously said by Tom Garvin, revolutions are what happens to wheels. They come round and round and round. And so a true revolution is something that actually only goes 180 degrees.
Okay.
You change the entire nature of society's existence. The Russian Revolution is an example of a proper revolution by definition, in which the imperialist czarist regime is completely done away with. The modes of economic production, political participation, the nationalization of land, these are revolutionary movements that change society.
Okay.
A revolution, as we even see in Ireland sometimes, when the establishment of the Irish Free State puts into power a collection of politicians who all of a sudden wear silk top hats and coattails and behave very British-like, we say, well, all we've done is paint the mailboxes green. You know, is this a real revolution or has anything changed at all? No, what we see, I think, on January 6th is an insurrection. I would even hesitate to call it a coup. The idea of a coup, like a coup d'etat, or say the cutting of a head, is to replace the executive position of power with another executive. We'd kind of already done that with the election of a new president.
So this is really interesting. And this is, the New York Times had an article where they interviewed historian Erica de Bruin, who has a book on coup d'etats. And she said, no, this wasn't a coup because it didn't really work. But I do wonder, looking at examples in history of self-coups, whether it's Louis Bonaparte, Napoleon, in the 1850s, or in Peru in the 1990s with Alberto Fujimori. And so the difference is a self-coup, or in the Peruvian case or in the Latin American case, it's called an autogolpe, is that where an executive basically tries to overthrow the government to stay in power.
Yes.
And against another branch of government, and symbolically having the president's supporters storm the legislative seat of government. Does that at all mesh?
Yeah. I haven't read de Bruin's book. I'd really like to. That's interesting, because I've always interpreted the coup as that the essential functions of the government and the economic modes of production and consumption essentially remain the same. You just replace the executive. And that's why we think of coups in the terms of, say, Latin American coups in which the military involved, that you're simply taking one executive and replacing it with another. So like you might say a self-coup, or even in Russia near the end of the Cold War with Yeltsin the transition of power there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even want to use this phrase. It might be used to incite further violence. What we're talking about in the academic definition is actually civil war. There's two factions that are seeking to gain power of the executive over one another. it didn't come to any significant violence, and I don't downplay the shooting that occurred, but it's a struggle for power over a single executive, not necessarily wanting to change the nature of the government. Although I think it could probably be argued that some of the Trump supporters would certainly like to change some aspects of the government, particularly removing the red tape of some right. bureaucracy that would that keep checks and balances operating.
So in the context of France in 1848, and you could so there's sort of these revolutions that happen all over Europe, and you have these, you know, democratic governments raise, and in France you have, they change the government and then decide at the end of the year to have a presidential election. And Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous sociologist who came, who wrote literally the book Democracy in America, this Frenchman gets to help write this constitution. And he's like, well, let's just have like a one-term office. And I think it's so interesting, Louis Bonaparte, who is the nephew of the first Napoleon, has, you know, runs on this platform of law and order and wins in a total landslide. Right. And then a few years later, you know, and this is after he sends an expedition to stamp out the Republic of Rome in Italy, he concocts, as his term is up, a sort of self-coup, makes himself the Emperor Napoleon III, and basically France isn't democratic for about 20 years until the Franco-Prussian War, and he gets himself, you know, caught by the Germans.
Yeah. Very, very, very silly military maneuver there. I don't know if I'm quoting Machiavelli or Star Wars, but those in power seek to remain in power, and I don't know. I think France had some preconditions that might have led to this turn of events, particularly after the French after the exile and finally the death of Napoleon Bonaparte. There's a succession of rulers, and if you talk about revolution as coming full circle, Louis XVIII is put back on the throne after the exile of Napoleon, bringing us right back to the Bourbon monarchy. But then power shifts and successions change in 1830. So by 1848, a platform of law and order would be very welcomed, I think, by the French people.
Right.
And maybe this is, I don't know, what we saw on the Capitol, some law office and security enforcement not putting up too much of a resistance against those coming into certain sections of the building. The coup d'etat that we see with Napoleon III staying in power, I'm sure was probably welcomed by many people in society whose interests he had promised to protect, landowners mainly, and businessmen, and those with a vested interest in the monetary stability of the country. And, but nevertheless, it doesn't escape the definition that you identified there.
Because part of what that's doing is the first order of business is for the executive to stay in power when they might lose it. And then the second would be is to expand executive power at the expense of legislative power.
Yeah, consolidation, and as we see in the examples of fascist Italy and Germany, almost a pseudo-legal framework for doing so, allowing legislation to go through that essentially says that you can do whatever you want, or you know, certain elections, if you return so many number of seats, you get them all.
Yeah.
And you could say, well, you know, it was done legally. And you say, you know, you roll your eyes and say, right. Well, technically it was done legally. But
this is an important sort of segue to discuss this interwar sort of fascist period in the early 20th century. So we come out of World War One and these old sort of, they're all kind of like these liberal monarchies. World War One is just such a devastating disaster. We're here with Justin Stover, a history professor here at ISU. And you're teaching a class right now this semester on World War One. And so coming out of that, you have the Weimar Republic in Germany. You have, you know, a more democratic society in Italy. But first, you know, what's so kind of interesting is you have the March on Rome in Italy in 1922. And, you know, it's the March on Rome, but Mussolini's power is up in Milan where he has his newspaper. Right. And the interesting thing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about the March on Rome, is it technically doesn't happen. The black shirts are amassed. And what happens? The king telegrams Mussolini and says, OK, you can be in charge.
It's an orchestration, absolutely. And it's, okay. This is what I mean, is that I don't believe in coincidence anymore. When you see things today, yeah. Where in 1922, Mussolini and his followers of the Italian Fascist Party are able to gain such a following based on a variety of factors, but the majority of it is the economic devastation that ravages Italy, sure. Inflation. Italy had technically been on the winning side of the war, yet had no spoils to show for it. Mussolini's following is based on promises of stability, law, order, jobs, make the trains run on time, and particularly to crush, in that time and period, the political enemies of capitalism, which would be the communist movement. So we've said the red specter of communism haunts Europe after the Russian Revolution and the First World War.
Right.
But the March on Rome is completely orchestrated. If you go to YouTube, has these as well, you can watch this almost Hollywood style film about Mussolini's March on Rome and the seizure of power. It had all been.
And they shot it after the fact.
After the fact, yeah. Now, there are camps. I mean, yeah. Like you said, his base of power in Milan, the black shirt, Fascisti Combattimento, the black shirts in right. Italy, are rallied as a bodyguard, not merely of Mussolini, yeah. but of the ideology.
And this is really important because basically Mussolini was able to intimidate.
It is antithetical to think of Mussolini as anything but a thug, a fascist, a bully. And of course he was those things. But he also, I think, he had a very mature political intelligence. Before the First World War, he was a devout socialist. The war changes right. his mind. He's actually elected to parliament before the March on Rome, but he doesn't have anything, or his party have any kind of majority.
Right.
But it's this populist surge of public support, and particularly amongst veterans of the Italian military class, that rally around him and say, where's our victory? And a victorious nation should not be this downtrodden. The king, Emmanuel II, wants to concede and say, fine, this person has a following, he's popular, he has radical solutions. The sitting prime minister, his name's Luigi Fracta, loses his mind and just says, you cannot possibly dissolve democracy in this way that would give power to this man and his party simply because they demand it. But that's what happens. And Fracta steps aside and Mussolini is put into the position of the premiership. And it's the following year in 1923 when they pass something called the Acerbo Law, which essentially right. clears the way for a legal pathway to a dictatorship. But you hit on it, Zach, perfectly, in the sense that when the Acerbo Law is being voted on in the Italian parliament, the fascist black shirts are all over the place. They're outside the hall. They right. are in the city. They are intimidating, essentially, members of parliament.
This is really important because it's been reported today that congressional Republicans have admitted that they are scared to vote to impeach or convict the president due to death threats and intimidating
right.
factors. And so we're in for this sort of scary kind of potentially, hopefully that is not the case, but as of you can see a certain amount of intimidation. And what strikes me as interesting is that you're talking about fascist Italy and Mussolini, how they're veterans, and basically you're talking about how the sort of conservative political landscape, the respected conservative political landscape, gives in and thinks mm-hmm. that maybe we can control this guy. And a similar right. thing plays out in Germany when, you know, Paul von Hindenburg and some of these other conservative figures in the Weimar Republic feel like they can control yeah. Hitler as chancellor, but at that point they sort of lose the thread.
Yeah, and you know, watching the events of January 6th unfold, all I'm thinking in the back of my head is, when is the Reichstag? When is the false flag of the Reichstag fire in 1933? Blame it on a communist.
Yeah.
Use this state emergency as an excuse to suspend civil rights and declare martial law. I'm sitting here in real time, just reliving 1933 once again.
And just really quickly for our audience here, Justin, the Reichstag was the German parliament.
The German parliament building.
Right.
And
okay.
In all of this, I think we have to understand, and this is what makes the dialogue in today's politics, I think, so difficult, is that these are not simple analogies. They're not simple comparisons. The state of Italy after the First World War, the Weimar Republic itself, the way it was founded, by whom it was founded, this was highly critical by extreme factions such as the Nazi Party. The fact that the Weimar Republic never held, no party ever held an outright majority in its existence means that parties had to work together. And because of that, really nothing was getting done in a political sense. So when someone of a minor party promises to make change, if only the levers of bureaucracy would be pulled away, if only the red tape could be cut, I could get things done. These types of things, that's dangerous talk. Right. And I wouldn't downplay the threats against our congressional leaders. You never downplay the threats of people who are so emboldened by their ideology that they don't see common sense.
And what's interesting is, so the Nazis and Hitler gained power in 1933. Mm. But at the same time, we were talking about the Beer Hall Putsch, which is in 1923. Hitler modeled it after the March on Rome, but he does it in Munich, which is in Bavaria, not the country's capital in Berlin. And it becomes this sort of disaster from, you know, the Burger Braukeller? You know, so there's free beer is passed around, but it's not a really great example of treason. And so then they try to make a parade out of it, but that turns violent. Then Hitler goes up on treason charges, but makes a spectacle out of the trial. So I'm just curious, in a sense... Like, is January 6th, do we contextualize it as kind of the 1920s or the really, really scary 1930s? I mean, what's a way to understand it?
I think my read would be, if the Beer Hall Putsch is what we're focusing on, I think the 20s are more appropriate. And the word that would link them both is the followers of the president that are on Capitol Hill and those that are in the Beer Hall. The word would be illegitimate. Hitler and his followers view the Weimar Republic as illegitimate, as being a stab in the back of the German people, particularly in their hour of need towards the end of the First World War. Now, this is all myth-making, right? The German army was collapsing and falling back. But the compromise that Hitler sees is a bastardization of the German Empire and everything they fought for. And so to try and overthrow the Weimar Republic is simply, in his mind, to do a legitimate act of restoration of the people's right. And I don't need to make the analogy that those who are storming the Capitol saying, stop the steal, view the election results as illegitimate, and therefore the succession of President-elect Biden as illegitimate. So that rallying cry of illegitimacy, I think, is what links the two. But I'm not sure that those who stormed Capitol Hill had that context in mind. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that.
Yeah, I think that's...
It's far more nuanced than just breaking into the Capitol. And when Hitler found with Eric Ludendorff was with him, a very prominent figure in the First World War, he and his followers are marching to the Bavarian essentially the municipal center to seize power there and then give alert to their followers throughout the country to do the same. They're stopped by the police force and they're fired, their shots are exchanged and people are hurt and some are killed. But nevertheless, the functions of the state act and the state survives. And so we saw that eventually as well in Washington.
I mean, it's so interesting too, for me, you know, and I teach journalism and media studies. The show is called Know Your Media. We are on public radio and the sort of indelible images of them beating up photographers, stealing Associated Press equipment. The Associated Press goes back to 1848, which we were just talking about. And smashing it up. Of course, you can't really set digital media equipment on fire like you can books. Yeah. But it's also interesting, in Munich in 1923, they were unable to seize the government, but they were able to, Hitler's, you know, henchmen were able to smash up the Munich Post newspaper. And so it's...
The free press is the enemy of those who would seek to control, I think, populations. So... that would definitely be a target. And, you know, they didn't have smartphones with very high definition cameras in 1923, which, I mean, if you could amalgamate all the various footage, I'm sure that was taken inside the Capitol, it would paint a very terrifying picture. So going back to the questions of what this was, domestic terrorism is what this was. This is despite fear and intimidation into elected officials to vote a certain way. And I'm not sure what the manifesto was or what the end game in all of this was, except to make a spectacle that Trump's followers would contest the election.
Well, we've been talking today with Dr. Justin Stover of the ISU History Department. Justin, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Zach.
This and all past episodes of Know Your Media can be found at KISU.org. Click on Programs and Know Your Media.